This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
So the carbon cycle is one of the great cycles on Earth. The carbon flows from the atmosphere, carbon dioxide, down into oceans or down into trees, down into soils where it can be stored, and eventually it is released again and goes back up in the atmosphere, and you have these really wonderful life-giving cycles on the planet.
What if the solution for reducing our collective carbon footprint were right under our feet? My guest today on Sea Change Radio believes it is. Soil is a natural and planet-healthy repository for CO2. A slight rise in carbon dioxide levels in the soil could help fend off the encroaching warming of the climate. Author Courtney White talks about this as well as the environmental problems caused by today's common farming practices. Next on Sea Change Radio.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm joined by the author of Grass, Soil, Hope, A Journey Through Carbon Country, Courtney White. Courtney, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex, for having me. Happy to be here.
So we like to try to focus on solutions to seemingly intractable problems like climate change here on Sea Change Radio. And your book really does just that, in that you focus on trying to increase the carbon content of our planet's soils to offset greenhouse gas emissions. Can you first talk about what was the inspiration behind this, and then I want to dive into the nitty-gritty of the soil.
The nitty-gritty of the carbon details.
Exactly.
Yeah, you bet. Let me back up just a little bit and kind of give you my story, which flows into how I ended up writing this book. I come out of the environmental movement myself. I was a Sierra Club activist for many years. I live out here in New Mexico, and did a lot of classic environmental stuff through the 90s. And then one day I met a rancher, Jim Winder, who ranches in the southern part of the state. And Jim was doing things differently. He managed his cattle differently. He had a different attitude towards environmentalists. He was trying to find some common ground. This is back in the wild and woolly grazing wars of the 1990s. So Jim and I started talking, and we started a little nonprofit together with another conservationist. And one thing led to another. We started looking at land differently, the way animals use and graze land. We got involved in a bunch of ecological restoration projects through our nonprofit. We ended up running a ranch, doing local grass-fed food, all these kind of interesting out-of-the-box things for me. I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona as a suburban boy. And then one day I opened a publication that was sent to me titled Mitigating Climate Change Through Food and Land Use. And I opened it up and I looked inside. It was a publication of the World Watch Institute. And I looked at their summary, and there were five things that said we had to do in order to affect climate change on the land side of this. And our little nonprofit, the Kavira Coalition, was doing all five: building soil carbon, protecting open space, restoring degraded ecosystems, climate-friendly livestock practices, and local food production. And so this really sort of set me to thinking, wow, I didn't realize we could actually affect the climate by managing the land. And so I looked into it, and I found a number of carbon pioneers, scientists, and other folks who are also working on this. And basically what I found out was that you can sequester carbon dioxide in soils through plants, photosynthesis. You know, the carbon is broken off from the O2, CO2, and it goes into the soils. And some soil scientists have done some math that if you could increase the soil carbon by just a little bit across rangelands, large landscapes, you could actually potentially sequester a lot of carbon dioxide or carbon in soils. So that kind of set me thinking. We ended up putting a conference together in 2010. From that conference, called the Carbon Ranch, came the book. I met all these really cool, interesting carbon pioneers. I decided to tell their stories. I went around, did the research, and then ended up writing the book and feeling hopeful about the potentials for soil carbon, one of the great carbon sinks on the planet, to improve our situation.
And I want to get into some of those stories and learn more about soil carbon and no-till farming. But first, why don't you tell our listeners, how did we get here? What are some of the practices that led to the current situation with our soil?
It's interesting. If you look at what climate scientists tell you about how much CO2 is up in the atmosphere, they'll trace that all the way back to the beginning of agriculture or the beginning of the use of plowing 5,000 years ago. There's a famous hieroglyph on an Egyptian temple of a plow, you know, Egyptian farmer. And what they found out is that when you start turning soil over with a plow, you release the carbon that's stored in the soil. So this carbon is, you know, if anybody who's listening is a gardener, you know what that dark, rich soil in the garden is. That's carbon mostly. And when you turn it over with a plow, it oxidizes the heat and the air and the atmosphere, send all that carbon back up into the sky. And so really our climate problem began not in 1850, but in 5000 BC when we started to till these carbon-rich landscapes. And then over time, in our agricultural practices developed to the point where we were burning up a lot of carbon in soils, a lot of plowing. And this was news to me. You know, I didn't know anything about plows. I didn't realize that plowing was actually not good for the life in the soil.
So why did it first become popular? It works, obviously, to some degree.
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, the very earliest, and I have an archaeology background. I asked my wife this question, who's an archaeologist. In the early days, it was sticks and, you know, sticks in the ground, poking holes, dropping seeds. Somebody got the bright idea 5,000 years ago to turn the soil over. In fact, the first time you plow land, it's really, really fertile, right? It's got all that carbon in the soils. When they plowed up the plains here in America, wow, all that rich carbon soil, the plants grew like crazy. And then later, after that carbon got oxidized or washed away or blown away, they had to start to fertilize. And that's where chemicals come in, chemical fertilizers, nitrogen, phosphorus. And then we get the problems we have today with industrial agriculture. So the plow was really kind of the start of it. And then in the mid-19th century, you get industrial agriculture starts. You got tractors in the 20s. And the whole thing scales up, and you've got a lot of erosion. And a lot of that carbon in the soils is now washed away. And actually, this is an opportunity for us. I like to say to folks, think of carbon in your soils as a glass full of water. We poured half of it out historically, but that half of the glass is waiting to be filled up again with carbon. And that's what the book is about, how different people, farmers, ranchers, restorationists, other folks are recarbonizing the soils, filling that glass back up.
And how much of a problem is our supply chain for our food system and the CAFOs and factory farming?
Well, it's part of the problem, absolutely. I guess we should back up and say there are kind of two parts to this. One is, first part is the emissions, you know, the amount of greenhouse gases that go up. So that's carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide. So farms, factory farms, feedlots generate a lot of greenhouse gas emissions. Cow belches produce a lot of methane. So getting a handle on that side of it by reducing the amount of emissions that go up. What the book is about is the other side of that, which is how do we soak up those excess greenhouse gas emissions, carbon dioxide in particular, that are in the atmosphere. And you can link them so that a sustainable ranch or a grass-fed producing ranch, meaning a ranch that animals eat grass from birth to death, has a smaller carbon footprint. So it is not producing as much emissions, especially if it's local. It's a local food system. All those carbon footprint things come down, and the healthy soils that are being generated by managing the cattle well, building soil, are soaking up CO2. So there's a kind of a classic win-win for everybody.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Courtney White. He's the author of Grass, Soil, Hope, A Journey Through Carbon Country. So, Courtney, if you can break down the science for us and tell us what the average farmer is doing to their soil and what kind of impact that ultimately has on the environment, and how no-till farming and how this, what you're proposing, can mean in terms of, if you can kind of spell out the difference and what that means for the atmosphere ultimately, that would be terrific.
So soil organic matter is 58% carbon. And so, and carbon in soils, which, you know, carbon is the element carbon, can comprise anywhere from 4 to 5 to 6% of the material that's in soil. So they tend to look at carbon content as being 4%, 3%, 5% of the total volume of soil below your feet. What we've done historically is degrade the ground, or kind of burn that carbon off by plowing or other things. And in many places, the carbon content has dropped to 2%, 1.5%. In a bunch of Australia where I was, and that's a chapter in the book, it's dropped to less than 1% of the soil is carbon, which, you know, carbon is the fuel that feeds the biology in the soils. And so without that fuel, that biological life just doesn't work as effectively. So, for example, Jeffrey Creek on the olive farm there in Petaluma, he set out to recarbonize that small ranch. So he raised the carbon content from 2% to 4%, back to where it was originally, and then he was aiming to raise it higher, 5%. And by raising that much carbon in the soils, he was getting all this collateral effect. And he was doing it, by the way, mostly by composting. So he would take the waste materials from the olive, which would have been thrown away or dumped in a landfill or something. He was recycling them, composting them, and putting that carbon back on the soil, and that plants were just eating it up, and the microbes. So he was raising the carbon content to 4%, 5%. When you do that, when you raise carbon content from 2 to 4%, double it in a sense, across large landscapes like rangelands, grasslands, which is the largest land type on the planet, you end up soaking up just large amounts of carbon dioxide. Not everything, but potentially lots of it, because it's now being stored in the soil through photosynthesis. Those plants are pulling it in, pulling off that seed, storing it through their roots in the soil. So it can be a large amount of carbon dioxide theoretically, and that theoretically is the challenge. How do we actually do it?
And can you give us an idea of the range of types of no-till farming practices that kind of meet you and your colleagues' seal of approval, and where these are being perpetuated mostly?
So on the ranching side, a lot of rapid rotational grazing, the kind of grazing that mimics natural grazing behavior of wild animals. So wherever you've got those kinds of ranches, and there's a bunch in California, a bunch here in New Mexico and other places, those ranches, the way I look at it, are all being carbon friendly, probably storing more carbon in the soils than they were when they first started. On the farming side, since plowing does terrible things to the life under the ground, there's now a big movement on the no-till side. And no-till, for those who don't know, is exactly what it sounds like. It is a no-till farming system. It's a chisel drill that cuts through the soil, doesn't turn anything over, just makes a little slice. It drops the seeds down low, and then pulls out. And so the ground has its cover. Or the farmer can do that to bare soil and then plant a cover crop, like hairy vetch or something. And so it's got green growing over the top of it. No bare soil. And bare soil is what we don't want. We don't want bare soil.
Why is that?
Well, then the carbon in the ground is being exposed to the rain and the sun and the oxygen, and up it goes. So the carbon cycle is one of the great cycles on Earth. The carbon flows from the atmosphere, carbon dioxide, down into oceans or down into trees, down into soils where it can be stored, and eventually it is released again and goes back up in the atmosphere, and you have these really wonderful life-giving cycles on the planet. Some are long, geological time, you know, like volcanoes and oceans doing their thing, which is a long, long cycle. And some of it's a short cycle, which is how plants pull down the carbon dioxide, pull it apart, and that carbon goes in the soil where the microbes eat it. And then eventually the microbes die, and they also belch in a sense, and that CO2 then kind of leaks back up into the atmosphere. So there's this great cycle of carbon round and round and round. What you want to do is store more carbon in soils, then leaks back up into the atmosphere. And these are the practices we're talking about. What practices sequester more carbon than leak back up through natural processes? So keeping that ground covered, keeping something green and growing over the whole ground, putting down roots, which then pulls that carbon out of the carbon dioxide and stores it. If you've got bare ground, then there's nothing, there's no photosynthesis going on. That the carbon that's in the soil will eventually just sort of leak right back out, because there's nothing cycling it there, nothing holding it in place. So that's why no-till has become kind of a big deal. It's a pretty big movement now in the Midwest. What I write about in the book is a development out of Rodale Institute in Pennsylvania called organic no-till, because a lot of no-till uses pesticides and herbicides to keep the weeds down. Tilling is good for weeds. Plowing turns the ground over and kills weeds.
Is that maybe why originally tilling became so popular, is to get rid of weeds?
Yeah, it's a weed control process, you bet. It brings up those nutrients, turns the soil over, and weeds don't get established. And that's, yeah, you bet. So in no-till systems, like the big kind of no-till systems in the Midwest, use a lot of herbicides and pesticides to keep the weeds down, which, if you like organic agriculture, that's not a good idea. But Rodale came up with really a fascinating, wonderful process called roller crimping. Another practice that I went to Australia to see, it's not practiced much here in America yet, I hope so soon, it's called pasture cropping. This is where a sheep farmer will no-till drill a crop, in this case oats, into his pasture in the winter. So then the oats come up, and he harvests them, and then he puts the sheep out on the pasture. So one piece of ground is getting two crops, an oat crop and a pasture crop for his animals. And that symbiosis between the annual crop and the perennial grass, is nature really likes that. And the microbes love it. The soil gets built quickly. It's very synergistic, and it produces food. We got a lot of big population to feed, and it does so by building topsoil. And when you build topsoil, you store more carbon. They've measured it on his ranch. He's doing fabulous things. And also, when you build topsoil, you hold more water. And for drought, you got drought in California. We got a drought out here right now. I'm looking out the window at some pretty dry country. When you build topsoil with carbon, you can store more water. They've measured it increases the water holding capacity of soils a lot. So, I mean, just like a garden. Anybody who's a gardener knows that dark, rich soil will soak up a lot of water.
Well, he's all bawling about you down on the farm. The cows bawl, the pigs bawl, the horses bawl too. Miss you so much at times, all we can do.
Miss you so much.
Weeping and wailing, friend,
you come on soon.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Courtney White. He's the author of Grass Soil Hope, A Journey Through Carbon Country. So Courtney, can you talk about some of the other countries where no-till agricultural practices have really taken off?
There's a couple profiles, a couple instances in the book about what's going on in Europe. And this is not so much on the no-till side of things, but there's a very interesting project in southern France that I profile where they actually put solar panels above their farm fields. And the reason they did it was to generate renewable energy while shading the crops from intense temperatures. And this is a concern about climate change. Hotter and drier conditions, plants lose water in the sun, and they got this bright idea of putting these big solar arrays above farm fields to shade the plants, not entirely, but to shade them kind of half and half. And then they figured out the science of that, which is that they could actually not lose much productivity and generate a bunch of electricity all from the same plot of land. And in Europe, this is important because they are constrained by their land. They don't have much space for agriculture. And also the concern about biofuels and fuel production from farmlands, which is happening all over the world. This was a way to have energy production and food production on the same plot of land, which is very different than how most of the fuel versus food debate has been going on. Like you either grow corn for ethanol or you grow corn for food. This was a different way of kind of looking at that. That was pretty inspirational. The Europeans take climate change more seriously than Americans do, including agricultural systems in America. So they're kind of way ahead of us on thinking about adaptations to hotter and drier or more extreme conditions, thinking about things like solar panels above farm fields, that kind of stuff. So we could certainly learn from Europe these things. I have a chapter in the book on Australia, as I mentioned. Australians are also kind of way ahead of us in some respects. I found Australians eager and willing and happy to try new stuff. Just, hey, that sounds great. Let's do that. Let's try this other thing. Yeah, let's do that. Pasture cropping is a good example. I also have a little profile on a FLIRD, which is a combined sheep and cattle herd, a FLIRD. And you don't see many of those here, but there's a fair amount of them in Australia. That's as much overseas as I get in the book. I know no-till is being practiced in a lot of places now, Africa and Asia, as they try to struggle with how to keep their soil intact through these hotter and drier conditions that are developing.
Well, one of the things that we hear a lot about is if people stopped eating so much beef. What did you learn in your research for this book, Courtney, that spoke about beef production and consumption?
Yeah, and this comes up a lot, kind of the methane question we refer to it as. And there's a couple of things about it. You know, methane is produced, it's called entropic emissions, I believe. It's a natural process when cows and other livestock chew grass and whatnot. They produce methane in their intestinal system and belch it out into the atmosphere. And if you have a lot of cows, you have a lot of methane. And we have a lot of cows in the world. You know, it's so there's a lot of methane that's going up. And it's they're working on some technological answers to that, maybe ways to kind of reduce the methane production from livestock. But there's a kind of an important point here that folks lose sight of. One is that the real culprit for the climate right now is the fossil fuel that we're digging up from the ground, buried for 300 million years. So this is carbon that was laid down under the ground 300 million years ago. We're digging it up and we're burning it. And when we do that, we add that carbon to the carbon cycle. So it's new carbon. It's new carbon in the atmosphere that then cycles through it. And that's what's contributing to the rise in CO2, the parts per million that we hear a lot about. When cows belch, when methane comes out of a cow or another livestock, it's part of the cycle that's already there. So it's just cycling carbon that already exists. They got it from their plant. Carbon was in the plant. It's in the cow, comes out the cow's mouth. It goes up in the atmosphere. That's very different than digging up buried coal and burning it. That's adding vast more amounts of carbon to the cycle than a cow belching on a grassland somewhere. And so that's an important point that kind of gets lost in this. The other points are that wetlands produce methane. Rice paddies produce a lot of methane. And I haven't heard anybody talk about putting rice production out of business. Certainly a lot of people eat rice around the planet. So it's some finger pointing at cattle that I don't quite understand. I see cattle as part of the solution. The way we manage our grasslands, nature never farms without animals is an old saying in the organic industry. And yes, they produce methane, but there are ways to reduce the amount of methane they produce. The carbon footprint of a grass-fed ranch, local grass-fed ranch, I think is substantially less than a feedlot that consumes a lot of corn. We got to keep in mind, keep our eyes on the prize, which is that buried carbon in the form of coal, oil, and natural gas that we're burning and adding to the large amount of carbon we already have in the atmosphere. You know, I'm not advocating that we eat a lot of beef. I think we probably could eat less beef in general. We're as a planet, we're large. We eat a lot of animal products, and maybe we should eat less. I know in other parts of the world that beef consumption is rising. A lot of that beef coming from feedlots and from systems that are unsustainable, I believe. So I'm not. And if you're vegetarian, that's fine. It's not about one lifestyle over another. But if you are a meat eater, anybody listening to this, I would encourage you to ask a question about where your meat comes from. Is it from a carbon-friendly ranch? Is it a local ranch, grass-fed ranch? Is the farmer or rancher doing a good job on the land management side of this? And if they are, buy their product.
He's the author of Grass, Soil, Hope, A Journey Through Carbon Country, Courtney White. Courtney, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Alex, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Digga Rhythm Band, The Meters, and Little Feet. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.